This is Frank Collada, and you are listening to Gangland Wire. And if you're ever in Vegas, take the Frank Collada Casino Tour, 702-622-0850. Thank you.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Good evening, folks. Welcome to the studio of the Big Dumb Fun Show, Studio 4, in the classic old ice house in Midtown Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
And our other friend of ours, retired FBI agent, Bill Owsley. Say hello, Bill.
Hello.
Well, it's good to have you back here, Bill, and we're going to continue down this path of the wiretaps and the casino skim investigation, which was made famous in the movie Casino with Robert De Niro by, what was that guy's name that made that? Not Francis Ford Coppola. It was Marty Scorsese, who did another really good movie, I thought, about the mob. Even better movie, I thought, better depiction was Goodfellas. But that's my opinion on that. Everybody's got a different opinion, I've noticed on the Facebook. We're going to continue on down this. We had some wiretaps, and we'll have a couple more. Whenever you hear these wiretaps that I'm playing tonight or last show I did, it's always going to be Carl Tuffy DeLuna, who was the street boss or the underboss for the Kansas City family. He was headed up by Nick Civella, and he had a brother, Carl Civella, who was the acting boss when Nick was in the penitentiary. And he was always talking to Joseph Augusto, who was Kansas City's mole, shall we say, in Las Vegas, and particularly he worked at the Tropicana Casino. And the Kansas City mob, and you know, as the FBI learned by the end of this investigation, they had set up a stream of skim outside from the Tropicana Casino. It was probably around $40,000 a month at its peak, because when Bill Owsley tells the story about when you captured the courier coming in up at the airport. What kind of money did he have on him?
The skim courier was a fellow by the name of Carl Caruso, who ran junkets with the high-rolling gamblers to Vegas. And his job was to see Joe Augusto at the Trop and pick up the skim for that particular month, fly it back to Kansas City, and deliver it to the mob. So when our case was finally to be brought down, we timed it for one of the deliveries of skim, which happened to be on Valentine's Day, 1979. So this was the Kansas City massacre. We had search warrants for a whole bunch of people, and it was all keyed on Caruso arriving at the airport. And my crew went up there. Larry Wisher from the intelligence unit was with me with a couple of agents, and we waited for Caruso to come off the plane, and we collared him, brought him into a little office, and asked him to empty his pockets. For years, we would wonder, how was the skim delivered? Was it a secret part of his shoe, a hidden part of a suitcase, or a lining in his coat? And we figured it'd be some surreptitious thing. So I said to Caruso, take everything out of your pocket. So he reached into his inside left pocket and pulled out a packet of bills. He reached into his other pocket, reached out a packet of bills. And sitting on the desk was $80,000, 2 months skim.
Well, that's about 40 grand a month by my calculation. What about you, Aaron? Do you make 40 grand a month?
Not out of my left pocket or my right pocket.
Now
I've got to get a different jacket.
You need a different jacket.
I might explain $40,000, you know, it was substantial in the 70s, but as skim goes, it was modest. And that was because the Tropicana, ever since Augusto infiltrated it, which he did because of its financial dilemma, they had never gotten to the point where they could really skim. So the $40,000 was a beginning, and of course they had hoped, not knowing about the straw man case, that they would be skimming for a long time. But at that point, that was a modest amount. But it's what the hotel could afford without raising flags.
Interesting, you know, and we did a show on Angelo Lunardo, the Cleveland mob boss, underboss, and then was promoted to boss during this time, I believe. And he, when he testified, or he talked to the agents or something, he indicated that at the peak, he thought it was around $100,000 a month was coming to Chicago from the Stardust.
So, more than that. More than that,
okay.
Yeah. Our figures that we eventually were able to put together from records seized from DeLuna. I don't have them offhand, but at times Kansas City and Cleveland share alone was $86,000. I remember one month.
Wow.
That's just for them two. Now you got to figure in Chicago and Milwaukee.
Wow.
So it was substantial.
So it may have been $200,000 to $300,000 every month.
Every month.
Some periods of time.
They didn't divvy up the skim equally.
No. We don't know what Chicago got. All we had was DeLuna's records of showing what was given to Kansas City, and at times Kansas City was given Cleveland share to pass on. We don't know what the total was. Chicago could have taken two times what they got.
They did.
Yeah, so we only know half the story, and we know that at times rivaled $100,000.
Well, that part of the story, that was simply one line of stream of income, because didn't Kansas City have their own casino, and a skim off of that one is separate from Chicago?
That's the $40,000 that started coming in. And Nick, interestingly enough, because Nick infiltrated the Tropicana without a Teamster Fund loan, that was considered his. He did not have to divide that with anybody. He had no partners, so to speak. But Nick was not an ignorant person, and he understood the big enchilada with Chicago. Of his own goodwill, he shared part of that $40,000 with Chicago. He didn't have to. He was getting that share from the Stardust and the Fremont, or what we'll call the Chicago scam, plus his share from the Trop.
That's a little bit like in the hierarchy of the mob, the street person, the soldiers, if you will go out and make some kind of a score, have a book going, and he'll have to kick so much upstairs to Tuffy, and then Tuffy will kick so much of that on up to Ripe or to Corky or to Nick, correct?
Right.
So it's kind of the same way. You know, Lunardo also, he made another claim. I have to ask your opinion on this, Bill. He said that really Milwaukee was really just almost like a subset of the Chicago outfit. And Kansas City was a little more independent, but really was under Chicago. But Cleveland was not. They said he claimed that they were really had any allegiance. They really had it to the Genovese family in New York. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, it does. At first of all, Milwaukee, run by Frank Ballesteri, was a boss that was not highly regarded. In fact, I think Nick had absolutely no regard for him, called them fancy pants. They were dominated by the Chicago family. However, on the other hand, it was Ballesteri who Alan Glick went to when he was seeking a loan to buy the Stardust. It was Ballesteri who did the middleman stuff. And that surprised me at the time. I really wondered how that came about. We never got an answer. But yeah, they were a subsidiary. And Cleveland is considered more East Coast than West.
Oh, interesting. I never really thought about that before, but it makes sense. You talked about the notes you found at Tuffy's house, and that was when you served the search warrants, and you found these kind of detailed notes that may help make sense of a lot of these wiretaps. And we were talking about Harry Reid and his connection to the Chicago outfit and the Kansas City outfit and Milwaukee, this cabal, if you will, of we need the Midwest mobs. How about that? We just call them the Midwest mob families. And you know, what was his true connection to them, and was he bought and paid for by them? For all we know, he does, and he was, or maybe he wasn't. There's never really been a smoking gun, kind of a like a wiretap of evidence or a witness that came in that had firsthand knowledge that I know of. But you did find further evidence. What was that evidence in those notes in Tuffy's house?
Well, first of all, the first question, Reid was an asset, we believe, probably developed mainly by Joe Augusto through the attorney Jay Brown. And that asset, I don't know that it belonged to anybody, but it benefited Chicago, Cleveland, and all, because they were getting money from the Stardust, and that hotel needed to be protected, and Harry Reid was their man to protect it. And that, I don't believe that money passed hands. I think that this was an accommodation by Reid, who was, I'd have to say, bent in that regard, that... he was prone, maybe seeking down the road he would need their help. But for whatever reason, I don't think he got money. And Reid claims in his book that when the clean face allegation came out in public, he was exonerated by a detailed financial investigation and what have you and this and that. No, there wasn't any indication, and I don't think it was a pay-for-play. They didn't get money. It was I don't know how to explain it, but he was a player. He was a player, and for whatever reason, motives. So that's that. But now...
Didn't you mention something in the break there about some furniture?
Yeah, well, I'm getting... Yeah, what happened is, first of all, when Reid took over... of course, we're not even on the wires yet, so this is a pre-story. But we eventually get the wires, and of course, then on the searches we get Tuffy's records, his little notations of all of his meetings and what he did, and the money's coming around, unbelievable, all in violation of mafia protocol, by the way. And one of the notes was a recordation of a meeting in Chicago with the Chicago boss, Joe Iupa, who was called 22, and his minions, some of his ranking people. And Tuffy made a little recording of that meeting, and he always did a little summary. And in this summary, he said that the entire conversation was of Crazy, that's Lefty Rosenthal, and Caesar, that's Joe Augusto, efforts to corral Clean Face. Now, this isn't long after he had become the commissioner of the board.
Of the gaming,
of the gaming commission.
For Nevada.
The head of the commission. So that was interesting. And then, subsequently to the search several years later, Augusto is now a cooperating witness. And during an interview with Augusto, just in passing, because we're still not very interested in this minion named Reid, who was nobody, He had left the office, and we had bigger fish to fry. But Augusto was talking about how, hey, this guy, Harry Reid, became the commissioner, and Jay Brown and I got together, and Reid had to get his own office because now he was the commissioner, had to be segregated from any conflict of interest with other attorneys. And so Jay Brown suggested that I come up with $30,000 to $40,000 for furniture to furnish Reed's new office. That was the extent of the 302, the interview form we used. Unfortunately, it wasn't pursued. God, now I wish it was, but it wasn't pursued. But taking the two together, a note saying their efforts to corral Cleanface. And at that same about time, either before or after the note, we don't know. They didn't even ask the date. We have the providing of furniture, which I see as part of the avenue to corral Cleanface.
So that term, the use of language here, I think is kind of important, Bill, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
And the term corral, that he actually wrote down corral clean.
Absolutely.
And so in my world, and where I grew up was on a farm. Now, I don't think any of these guys grew up on the farm. If we said we were going to corral something, then we wanted to get it under control.
Absolutely.
We needed to get it in a smaller fenced location, mm-hmm. which we called a corral.
Right.
Now, that's a famous, well-known term out in the Old West, which all these guys just like me grew up watching Westerns on TV and, mm-hmm. and in the movies, and I think probably by corral meant they needed to get him under control.
Absolutely, yeah. And
what they needed was an ally on their side. I mean, they still were essentially operating these three casinos through proxy of people like Crazy, Lefty Rosenthal, who had legal history that would disqualify him from actually being in that position of authority, right? So somehow previously, I mean, the Stardust, the Fremont, and the Tropicana did not open in 1977.
No, the Stardust had been there for years, and the other hotels had been there for years when Reid took over. But let me put. Interject this. Gary accurately explained the beginnings of the gaming authorities in Vegas. It was pretty seat of the pants and all. But by 1976, 75, into that era, they had become far more professional. Not only that, they had indicated a desire to keep organized crime out of Vegas. And as a indication of that, they created the Black Book. The Black Book was a list of individuals who were not welcome in any properties in Vegas or Nevada gaming. Anyone that accommodated them could be fined severely.
You couldn't even walk on the property. You couldn't even be found inside. You couldn't get a room in the hotel.
Eat
in a restaurant, could you?
No. You were not. You were barred from any licensed facility. So the board and the commission had gradually become a stronger, more disciplined operation. And, of course, the mob is smart enough to understand that creates a threat because they're secretly running these places and anything could happen. So any opportunity to corral somebody on the commission was a safety switch that they would welcome with open arms.
Well, their history would tell them that that's how they really operate their business.
Yeah, yeah. And the board, they were no dummies. They were, you know, they had filtered out a huge skim at the Stardust before Reid got in. And the Stardust was in trouble already when Reid came aboard. The board and the commission were very, very, very strong entities. And now here's an opportunity to get somebody on our side. That was huge.
So there was a time in 1978 when maybe they discussed this gift, and was this around there? They were recommended the professional the board. I'll get the two mixed up. The professional staff, the investigators, recommended that the Stardust license be suspended or maybe revoked after they caught a skimming operation going on where they had the scales rigged to misweigh the coins. I believe our old friend Dennis Gomes and Dick Law were the two auditors that stumbled onto that. And
that's probably a little known fact.
That is a little known fact. I just happened to talk to this Dennis Gomes when I started down this path, and he told me that. And so I started kind of researching that, and he was right. They did stumble into that. They didn't handle it the best, the most skillfully, but they did stumble onto it. There's no doubt about it, and brought it to everybody's attention. And so this first kind of, they were the first ones really to catch somebody in some skim, and they dug up some evidence and over the next few months. And so the Gaming Commission was going to move on the Stardust, and there was a hearing, and it was recommended by the professional staff that they they revoke their license. So what happened?
Well, and also besides the slot skim, they had found past posting in the book, which was run by Lefty.
No, that's Lefty all over there, man. Past posting.
Yeah, right. So there was.
Wait a second. What does that mean, past posting?
Well, that's when you bet after the game has begun.
It came from horse racing, posting. After the game, you know the outcome practically, or after you can kind of see what the outcome's going to become, then you can make your bets. Bet.
So anyway, they were in trouble on a number of fronts. So the Glick had to appear at this hearing, and as Gary said, the professionals, the board, had said it was severe enough the license should be revoked. And also, I'm sure as part of that was the fact that Lefty Rosenthal had been a part of the Stardust and had been had stuck in the craw of the board. So now they're in the midst of this hearing, and it's looking really bad. That evening, Augusto calls Tuffy, and he said, "It looks like I saved you guys." This is my interpretation. I don't have the exact words. But I did you a favor. We saved the Stardust. Clean face came through, and we got only a fine. And so the next day, he calls again and he gives them a blow-by-blow description, and I'll make it short and sweet. The hearing is going on. It's not looking good. Oscar Goodman is defending the Stardust. He's in a panic because he knows they're going to lose. He's yelling at Augusto and Jay Brown. Obviously, this means Goodman knew about the connection. And what Reed was doing. And he says, "For God's sake, do something. Get over there and do something." And Augusto says that the two of them, Jay Brown, who's called the channel, and this is a good reason, channel to Reed, the two of them go over and they sit down and have a discussion and ask Reed what they think he could do, and they throw out an idea, he throws out an idea, they come up with the idea that how about a $100,000 fine, which at that time, doesn't sound like a lot now, was the largest fine imposed, and they agreed that they would go for that, and Reed said, "I will do the best I can to get two more votes on my side, 3-2 would do it, the five-man commission." And that's what happened. So Augusto is crowing that clean face came through and we saved the Stardust. If they had followed the board's recommendation, the license would have been revoked. That's the end of skimming. And it would have been a disaster for the triumphant or the cabal that was sharing in those monies.
Yeah, it would have dried up several $100,000 a month, wouldn't it? Aaron, play that tape.
So $100,000 fine really isn't anything.
That's nothing.
They could have sent Caruso in,
yeah,
and he would have reached in his right and left breast pocket of his jacket and produced $100,000.
Aaron, play that tape Clean was able to deliver. Here's a little snippet from that wiretap. We only have just a little bit of it. Augusto, he's a bear to try to listen to. He repeats himself, and it almost sounds like there's a technical glitch in it. He says, I was happy to. Yeah. I was waiting for a third or a fourth. I was happy to, but Clean was able to deliver. So that.
And he's reporting this back to.
It had to be to Tuffy.
Yeah, he was reporting it to Tuffy. That's his regular conduit for information, and then Tuffy would take it to Nick. Later and report on the developments, and they would meet regularly to rehash what Augusto had told them as to what was going on.
And these are actually from wire. That was from a wiretap on Joe Augusto's house.
No,
it was on Tuffy's house.
This
probably.
This might have been Breckenridge. This was at the payphones they were using at a hotel. In the East Bottoms, the Breckenridge Hotel.
That sounds like another location for your smartphone.
Oh, you said that before, I think. I just keep forgetting to put
it on
there.
There's probably not a payphone at that location.
No.
Anymore. They've taken them out. I went in and looked. They're gone.
Yeah, Augusto, I don't know what he did in Vegas. I'm sure he cheated at times because he was lazy. But they would continually and religiously use payphones. What would happen is Joe would call DeLuna's home, and that was a signal call. And then they would talk about, in code usually, but a time and a place. Like he'd say 9 o'clock at 98. Well, 98 was the last two numbers of one of the payphones at the Breckenridge. They eventually moved to the Mule Bach, and he had different. So there was a signal call because Tuffy wouldn't have him discuss this on his home phone.
Mm-hmm. He already presumed that was bugged.
Yeah, yeah. They all thought their phones were bugged. So they would use payphones.
Which is kind of ironic that they would think that their phones were bugged because of the skim, when in fact, what had happened was their phones weren't bugged before this, but because of the events that occurred in the River Key, that was what brought down the bugs. Is that right?
No, they believe they were bugged because law enforcement is on one side, and to them, law enforcement uses bugs.
Yeah.
So this was just a part and parcel of their protocols. You don't talk on your home phone. You know,
but were their home phones bugged?
Oh yeah, yes. Yeah. We would we had gambling wires, and we had other wires, and that were effective. But for example, on Tuffy's home phone, and I don't know who else we had, but we got very little of substance from the big guys. They're smart,
mm-hmm.
You know. The little guys, the gamblers, and all. I could tell you a lot of stories about those guys, how stupid they are. And they would use the phone when they weren't supposed to. But the big guys are very careful.
And you know what, from a kind of the street view of this, folks, if you're out there on the street, you need to know, in order to tell the guys on the wiretap, and I say guys, it was all guys, it was all men back then, and tell the agents that were sitting on the wiretap that Tuffy was down there at the Breckenridge on the phone. before they just didn't keep it running all the time, just didn't monitor it all the time.
No.
And so you needed to have one up on Tuffy's house that somebody would be watching that one. There wasn't much traffic on it. If it was Tuffy or his wife, and you quickly could eliminate that and minimize, and if it was his wife, just turn it off. If it was Tuffy, then you heard him talking to Augusto, and by then they knew that the last two digits of each phone, what they were, and you knew where the phones were. And so if he said 9 o'clock and it was like 10 o'clock at night then, why, you knew it was, you know, it was some other time. And eventually they figure out, you know, you add so many hours to the number.
Sure.
And then you would know what time and which phone he was going to. So then you could, you didn't have to follow Tuffy around. You could just have somebody sitting down by the Breckenridge Inn, and you'd see Tuffy pull in about 5 minutes till whatever time it was that you knew he was supposed to be there, and you'd radio back to the office and say, hey, he just pulled in. So they'd just get on and listen to all of them until he got on the phone. So, you know, that's kind of a technical thing on
the
street level.
When he went in there, if there was anybody else using the phone, he'd probably give him a look or something like,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, like, I need to make a call here. You need to get off that phone.
There's a whole story about Larry Kopervica and that. But
it'd be kind of funny if you were one of the undercover agents sitting on that phone.
Well, we did.
That happened. Kind of blocking him going.
We did that.
You did that.
Happened. Yeah, that happened.
Well, or we left his phone open. And we're on the adjacent phone, so we could pick up bits and pieces that helped us give us the probable cause for that initial wiretap application. But yeah, as Gary says, you can't follow DeLuna every day, all the time, and not get burned. And it's very difficult. So in this, as Gary adequately described, saved manpower and what have you. Thank goodness they did it that way. But the they had all these protocols they went through, and Carl DeLuna was a very, I'd have to say, was a very dedicated mafia guy. He, except for keeping those records,
yeah,
he followed the rules.
Well, and the reason that he kept such detailed records, I thought, was because he wanted to be reimbursed.
He wanted to be reimbursed. That was the movie. I was in the movie
was
version.
Was that the movie?
He wanted to be reimbursed. What the guy said, what are you going to do, man? Deduct this on your taxes?
No,
it was actually kind of funny.
Yeah. Actually, there's a, in Augusto's testimony, he talks about that very fact, because one of the earlier conversations when they first established this routine, Tuffy actually recorded it, and we seized that recording, and Augusto learned about it, and he said that, according to Tuffy, it was because, and knowing DeLuna as I do, I believe this, DeLuna never wanted to be questioned about the legitimacy, accuracy, and all of what he was doing. That's why he actually would write down how much quarters he spent for the phone, and what his in and out expenses were for a room or flight to Chicago. He put it on there like we did our vouchers.
Right down to parking. He had on one of those notes, he had parking and right. So much money.
Right. But that was more DeLuna's makeup. He had the true mafia ethic.
So we're at a point in time where Joe Augusto has, after he came in, he told the FBI, he told you or whoever was debriefing him, that they had paid $25,000 to $30,000, maybe as much as 40 for furniture for Harry Reid's office through Channel One or through Jay Brown.
Right.
Now, later on, he would say that in this conflict over the Stardust Casino license, that he and Jay Brown went to Harry Reid and convinced him that they shouldn't revoke the Stardust license, but should merely give them a great big fine.
Right.
And so you've got all this. Now, kind of what happened, you know, why didn't that go any further than that? Because I know Harry Reid went on to become elected senator. He's now retiring from the Senate. He's had a long and kind of storied career as a Democratic politician, a very influential person in our seat of government. So what happened to that investigation?
Yeah. Well, first of all, let me preface it by saying after the Stardust hearing, there were quite a few more conversations, a lot of conversations about Reid, what he was doing, the conflict with Lefty, and all that substantiated this relationship. So it was more than just that one thing. We had quite a bit of stuff on him, but. The to get to your question, Harry Reid left the board in about 1979, I think it was. 4 years, I think, was his 81. 80 or 81, that was it. For anyway, following the takedown of our case, which was Valentine's Day 1979, we now were in the position of having to accumulate several years of all of this electronic surveillance, coordinate it with what was done in Milwaukee, the FBI there, Chicago, Cleveland, and Vegas. All of those offices were also investigating and doing work. All of that had to come together. All of the stuff we got out of Tuffy's house, which was voluminous, had to be brought together. And we had to start putting this together in the form that would support prosecutions. And that turned out to be two prosecutions. We called it the TROP and the Argent. The TROP had to do with the infiltration by Civella there. And the Stardust was the big case of Argent and all of the Teamster stuff. So all of this was going on. During this period, who was Harry Reid? We had no idea. I didn't have any idea. Where did he go? What did he do? And maybe who cares? He, in the scheme of things, was way down the line if he was even on our radar with all that had to be done.
At that point in time, Bill, you were looking to put in jail for long periods of time under a RICO statute of multiple, you know, racketeering convictions. Mm-hmm. You were looking to put in, you were hoping to put in jail Joey Doves, Joey Iupa,
yeah,
the boss of Chicago, Angelo LaPietra, one of the underbosses, Jackie Cerrone, another underboss or street boss. I kind of get their positions mixed up there in Chicago outfit. Frank Balistrieri, the boss of the Milwaukee family, Angelo Leonardo, the boss of the Cleveland family, Mashi Rockman, he wasn't the underboss. I'm not sure what his position was, trusted advisor or something.
Yeah,
he was a Jewish member of the Italian mafia, it sounded to me like. Leonardo ends up coming in and helping the government. And then in Kansas City, you know, Nick Civella, the boss, his brother and kind of co-boss or part-time boss, Carl Civella, Taffy DeLuna, the underboss, and Charlie Martina, who was a highly placed, trusted hitman and enforcer, and Martina was a guy you wanted to put away. I remember that. He was a bad dude. You did not want to have Charlie Martina show up on your doorstep and ask you questions if your shit was a little weak, shall we say, with the mob. And so that was your primary focus probably at that time. That was huge. That was the entire Midwest mobs, which some people would say Chicago mob in some ways, even alone, is more powerful than the five families in New York in some manner, because they just rule Chicago, this huge city of, and plus the whole Midwest. They just ruled it, and all the West Coast. They really influenced what Los Angeles and
Chicago. When the idea of a commission was no longer functioning because of prosecutions and the inability to get together, Chicago had been designated the overseer of everything west of the Mississippi. That's why Cleveland thinks of itself as...
Okay, I see. They would be east in the Mississippi. Yeah, I didn't really think about geography. Right. I know a little bit about geography. Yeah, I didn't think about that.
I had to remember that. Yeah. Before I said it, I've been thinking on it. Where but anyway, so they were a very, very powerful group, and their history was such. So, yeah, what you've described, I can't describe what a mammoth undertaking it was. And then on top of that, the attorneys, unbelievably, got the judge to rule. Now, normally we would transcribe all of the pertinent conversations that were going to be used in trial or had any exculpatory, anything that was pertinent. The judge ruled on their motion we had to transcribe every conversation.
Oh, my God.
So this is in the middle of trying to do everything else. So we had on our hands a mammoth operation and responsibilities, grand juries, all of that went with this business. And Harry Reid, to be honest, faded into the dust. Represented no great threat, and was not on our radar, and and then in 1983 or so, after testifying in the Trapp trial, which we successfully prosecuted all of the Kansas City Maine people and the functionaries in Vegas who were skimming, the casino manager, the assistant casino manager. And so on, Joe Augusto had a heart attack and died. So if Reid had been on our agenda, the main focus would have died with Augusto. But I won't even say he was on the agenda then. Really, we don't, I personally, because I retired in 85, 86, and that was the during the Arjun trial, was ongoing then. And after I retired, certainly I was out of the picture. And I doubt that anybody at the Bureau was thinking, who's Harry Reid? We didn't know. When he became a big shot and when he started to preen his feathers and write a book and use his political position to claim he had cleaned up Las Vegas, that's when I got upset and said, what do we have on Clean Face? And I went back and did the research. And that's what we're discussing today. But it was lost in time. And probably with the death of Augusto, we would have never been able to make it anyway.
All right. Let's... do my public service announcement. If you have a friend or relative that's got a problem with drugs or alcohol or any addictive behavior, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
Remember to download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $1.99, you can take your own personal guided tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And remember to buy or rent the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available on Amazon. And if you make a $25 or more donation at ganglandwire.com, Gary will send you an autographed copy of his DVD, Gangland Wire, as long as you live in the United States.
And go to my website and subscribe, and I'll send you a link to a free 2017 mob events calendar that I created and put up. I may have some hard copies made one of these days, but right now, just for subscribing to my website, you'll get a PDF of that calendar.
And Gary's got a book.
Well, I'm working on it.
It might be out by the time this comes out.
It might be out one of these days. It's getting close. It's It's going to be a lot about the story we just told tonight, and in a little more detail and a lot more in the electronic version you'll be able to of the book, the Kindle version. You'll be able to hear probably 25 or 30 snippets from wiretaps, maybe even more. I can't remember exactly how many I put up, but basically I put in the wiretap transcripts and link to the wiretap audios and explain each one of those wiretaps as you listen to it.
From the mouth of the men that did it.
Correct.
Ganglandwired.com.
All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Good night, Aaron.
Good night, Bill.
Good night, and it was a pleasure as always.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.
What do you do for a living?
I invoke my right under the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution and decline to answer the question.